This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Protests continue across the state and the nation as communities call for an end to police brutality. This moment of political resistance is just the latest in a long history of protest against unjust policing. Marchers and organizers are bringing the weight of their personal experiences with racism and discrimination to those demonstrations. Joining us now is Tosca Cooper, project manager and member of the Carolina Black Caucus. Tosca, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank, for having me today.
Good to have you. And Nia Wilson is with us, executive director of Spirit House in Durham. Welcome back, Nia.
Hi, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Also with us to help place this really current community experience into some kind of historical context is Adrian Lentz Smith, Associate Professor of History in African and African American Studies at Duke University. Adrian, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you. Tosca, you participated in one of the protests, at least in Durham this week. What inspired you to get involved?
Yes, I did participate on Monday evening. I would say my inspiration stemmed with my first protest I ever participated in back in 2015 in Minneapolis. And it was after the murder of Freddie Gray. And I remember that feeling of wanting to do something and not being able to go to Baltimore, but I was in Minneapolis and I said, okay, well, let me go outside and protest. And after seeing what happened with George Floyd, I felt the same way and I knew I needed to do something. And my something was going out there and protesting alongside many, many other people and fighting for what's right and fighting against injustice.
You talk about the inspiration for this being mediated experiences, things that you've seen happen elsewhere. What about your own experience with policing? What's that been like?
Well, I can say my own experiences have not ended up in some of the results of some of my other Black brothers and sisters, but I have had experiences when just driving and being stopped or pulled over by the police for whether it's a speeding violation or a headlight citation, being stopped and being questioned more than I think that non-Black people might be questioned as to, is this your vehicle? And how do you not know to turn the headlights on or things like that? So my experiences have been just questioning that I thought was unfair.
Well, talk about that one, because you sort of referenced, why don't you know how to turn on the headlights? But that actually happened to you, and it occurred to you later what that might have meant, right?
Right. Yeah, it did.
You could recount the experience for us.
Yeah. So this, I was actually in Atlanta, Georgia. I was traveling with some friends just for, you know, a road trip to Atlanta just to go have fun. And we were leaving a concert and we were turning down a street and this vehicle had automatic running lights, but the headlights were not turned on just because it was a rental and I was new to operating it. Within about maybe about a minute of turning around that corner, I saw police sirens behind me and that instant feeling of, uh-oh, what's going to happen? And I just tried to answer the questions, but why so many questions? Just for a simple, hey, just turn your headlights on. We hadn't even gone far yet. So I just never forget that experience. And it resonated with me more now in this present time than it did then, you know, 5-6 years ago, but it's definitely something that I'll never forget.
Well, is it true that, you know, you, because you had the running lights on, so you tried to explain that to the officer and then they,
I tried to make that explanation. Yeah, definitely. But, it wasn't good enough. And
well, because they asked
it
you,
didn't matter.
Yeah. Don't you know how to operate your own vehicle? Right.
Yeah. Shouldn't you know how to do that? And right. I'm like, well, this is a rental vehicle. Right. Don't they show you how to turn on the headlights? Don't you know how to do all these things before you get in the car? I thought a simple, hey, turn your headlights on, go on with the rest of your night would have been appropriate.
And it was someone later who suggested to you that what the officer was suggesting was that you stole the car.
Yeah, that's exactly what the assumption was.
So, I know that you spent part of your childhood in Johnston County. What was your experience there within that community in terms of race relations?
I would say pretty much unpleasant. My experiences growing up there more through my adolescent years, I will say that I didn't feel too comfortable having non-Black friends and the fearfulness of what might happen if we're hanging out in an environment or a situation and there's just one black kid and all these other white kids, and just this constant discomfort of living in a county that is known for being home of the Ku Klux Klan, and what that is like, and how do you make friends? How do you just go play or go to the store or do everyday activities?
Nia Wilson, I know, Executive Director of Spirit House in Durham. You have been working with county and city officials and the police for quite some time now over many, many of these issues. And I wonder, as you hear Tosca, you know, talk about her experiences, both getting involved in the demonstrations, but also a personal experience, how much that plays out and how much that has been an inspiration for you and what you're hearing in Durham and Durham County?
Thanks for having me again, Frank. You know, what I'll say about all of this is that about this moment and about, you know, the history of what has been happening in this country from the beginning around policing and why it inspires the work that we do as an organization is that, you know, people need to understand that Black people have been in protest of this war on our lives since the first time that Africans were brought to this country. This has been a constant protest of our ability to actually live. Our bodies have been policed from the very beginning. The chains that we were brought over here in are no different than the handcuffs that our people wind up in many, many times. And the fight for our very lives to fight for us to not be policed in the way that we are policed, for us not to live in fear in the ways that we have had to live in fear for our own lives, for the lives of our children, to be seen as the humans that we are, is a fight that we have been in constantly. People experience major things like what is happening now when someone's life is stolen from them. But every day, Black people have interactions with the police that are unjust in our neighborhoods, in our communities, driving our cars. And oftentimes, unless something like this happens, people who do not have those experiences don't understand what it means to live in a body that is constantly, constantly policed.
Adrian.
And so that is why we do the work that we do.
Well, and let's talk more about that work and its long history. Adrian Lentz-Smith at Duke University, I mean, you heard Nia talk about the fact that the protest has been going on for over 500 years. So talk about this week's direct action and how this plays, you know, where this fits in a larger historical pattern of protest.
So I think Nia Wilson is right, that this is not the first moment. It is the most recent manifestation of African American frustration and despair over ongoing state violence, right? And in some ways, louder and more intense because people have made these calls, made these protests, and made these requests over and over again. I think one of the key differences between sort of the origin moment of African American or African arrival in the Americas and things from the mid-19th century forward is that emancipation brought a conundrum for many white Americans, right? Where previously Africans or people of African descent were associated with enslavement, whether they were enslaved or not. What you see after emancipation is the dilemma of the Black citizen. What can that possibly mean, and how can we discipline that citizen to continue to control their labor? And from certainly the 1860s forward, police have played an important part of that, or policing has played an important part of that. How the policing has worked, how that disciplining has manifested, has transformed a bit in the 160, 70 years under discussion. But but there is a constant return to the police as instruments of both surveilling and corralling African Americans in particular ways. And African Americans have said that over and over again. They've placed their claims for citizenship, their articulations of a freedom that is truly free and truly meaningful, in the context of needing to, to use the image of the past week or so, of needing to lift the boot from their neck, right?
Well, I just wonder if you can explain then, how has the color line been so persistent in policing? And I'm curious about this because we know that capitalism requires the disciplining of labor. Labor has to hold its place and not demand its fair share of the profit, not demand its fair share of the equity in the company. Otherwise, the dividends don't get paid. So discipline is required for the working class and always has been. And yet this line, this other line about policing along color lines has been so persistent and so unbreakable. What explains that, do you think, Adrian?
Well, so I think it looks persistent and I think it looks identical where you see certain kinds of transformations that don't feel any different to the people who are experiencing domination, but our capital, the nature of capitalism has shifted over the past century, right? And that actually what we see now in part is not simply a need to discipline African-American labor, but an excess, like more laborers than the economy has need for them. So there's also what Ruth Wilson Gilmore has talked about as prisons as a place to put surplus labor, right? So African-American, the disposability and necessity of African-Americans has sort of wiggled around. At the same time, the color line is always being made and remade. And I think one of the interesting things is the way that it's not simply that policing enforces the color line, but that there's an interaction between how we understand, say, Black masculinity and femininity, criminality, right, which comes to be associated, Blackness and criminality come to be associated very strongly through a lot of propaganda work sort of in popular understanding and within the academy, but then also who is even seen or viewed or categorized as a person of color, right? So whiteness has changed, Blackness to some extent has changed, and what capitalism needs of labor has also changed in the period.
Well, let's talk about what this means then and bring it to, right up to the present and in this moment when these current protests are going on. We heard from a protest organizer in Kinston. Chris Suggs is the founder of the youth organization Kinston Teens, and he was organizing in Kinston a demonstration in this past week. And here's what he ran into.
One of the really disappointing things was that once this group of high school students began posting on social media that they wanted to have a peaceful protest in downtown Kinston, a very large section of our community began posting about organizing counter-protests, posting about possibly being in downtown armed and ready to protect businesses in case things pop off, as they said on social media. So there was a lot of, you know, backlash against these student organizers for organizing this peaceful protest when that shouldn't have been the case. So our protest did go very well, very smoothly. Lots of members of our community from various backgrounds and various ages came out to show their solidarity with the peaceful protesters and the protesters who were just, you know, expressing so much anger and frustration across our country. We had that same, you know, that same anger and frustration yesterday, but it did go very peaceful.
That was Chris Suggs, founder of Kinston Teens and organizer of a June 1st protest in Kinston. We're talking to Tosca Cooper, a project manager and member of the Carolina Black Caucus. Adrian Lentz-Smith is an associate professor of African and African-American history at Duke. And Nia Wilson, executive director of Spirit House in Durham. Nia, what about these demonstrations, these latest demonstrations? Have you noticed anything different about these protests and, you know, any sense of the impact that they might be having?
Well, one of the things that we've noticed is that there have been a lot more white people willing to be connected and in the streets at this time. I think that there are a number of reasons why that is. One being that we have done a lot of work. We've done a lot of work. This is a long fight, and we have done a lot of work in educating non-Black communities around the systemic nature of the racism within the police departments. And folks are beginning to understand that it is not about, although we're speaking about an individual incident right now, it is not about individual officers. People are beginning to understand that. I also think the current administration that has both displayed racism, blatant racism in words, but also in policies that are being created and acted, people can see that systemic racism is actually real and that something has to be done about it. And that so folks are willing and ready to put themselves on the line. I also think that COVID-19, where folks do understand that people of color are much more vulnerable to being sick and dying, and particularly in Durham, so many people have come out to help one another that they are also willing in this moment to put themselves on the line. So there's that young leadership from Black people is amazing. So it was really good to hear what that young man was saying. Young people understand what has happened. They understand the history in their communities, and they are ready to fight for their lives in ways that has happened in history before, most definitely. But they are ready to step up and step in and are unafraid to definitely command what's happening, to be in leadership, and other people are willing to follow them. And that has not always been the case in our movements.
No, but it's interesting that you say that, and I want to underscore that before you move on, because there's been so much talk about, you know, this younger generation not being involved. In order for them to have been in leadership positions and ready to go and as well prepared and as well trained as they were, it means all that work had been going on at a time when they had been criticized as a class, young people, for not being engaged. They were quite engaged, quite ready to go, and when this moment arrived, they stood up and took action.
And that is the thing that I want your listeners to understand, Frank, that this is not just a moment. That, as I said when I first started, this work, this fight, this protest has been going on, as you said, for over 500 years. There are people who are non-Black people, non-brown people, who just did not notice it before or did not see the relevance before, or did not understand that it also impacts and that they have a role to play in this moment. But that is happening, that is changing, and that has come through a lot of the public education that we've been doing for all of this time. You know, what we did in Durham took years before we had the wins that we've had here around shifting the way that the budget has been being used or around shifting the way that police stops have happened in Durham. There was definitely years' worth of work that precipitated those wins.
Yeah, I'm going to go back in a moment, talk more about that work. But Tosca Cooper, I want to ask you, because you talked about being in Minneapolis, or Minnesota, I guess you said, for Freddie Gray demonstrations back in 2017, was that? And now in Durham this year. Have you seen anything different? What's different about the experience for you?
Yeah, so my experience in Minneapolis, Frank, it was 2015.
15, yeah.
But I guess we get the dates mixed up because this is happening so frequently, unfortunately. Yeah. But the difference for me is this time around, I saw so much encouragement. So I think I left this protest feeling encouraged and inspired. On Monday night, there was a list of demands, and you could read off the list. It was a call and response. So we would read off the list of demands with everybody allowed. Something that was heartbreaking to me, though, was seeing children. So many young people, younger than myself, I'm 28, and there were children out here that had signs. And I'm thinking to myself, you don't even know how to write these signs. Your parents wrote these signs, but you're holding them because this could be you out here. That we're protesting for. So I think I left feeling encouraged after reading that list of demands, but I also was heartbroken too.
We're going to continue this conversation with Tosca Cooper, project manager and member of the Carolina Black Caucus. Thank you for being with us, by the way, Tosca. We enjoyed talking with you. Adrian Len Smith is going to stay with us, Duke Associate Professor of History, and Nia Wilson, Executive Director of Spirit House. As our conversation on the state of things continues in a moment, stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Adrian Lentz Smith, Associate Professor of History and African and African American Studies at Duke University. Also here, Nia Wilson, Executive Director of Spirit House in Durham, talking about how the community and local institutions, as well as local government, can work together to deliver on protesters' long-term goals. Nia, I know you've done a lot of work. We referenced it in the last segment with a lot of other people in the community, changing some of the priorities in Durham over policing and what was the view on public safety, which had at one point been more officers and more jail space. And through long conversations, those conversations were reshaped and shifted a bit. Tell us about the demands now and how you see these demands fitting into that larger context of a different changing ideas about what public safety means.
Sure. Well, one of the things that we have been working in Durham to demand is a divest and invest kind of plan that has us restructuring the way that our budget is spent and also rethinking what safety looks like. Last year, we presented a proposal, a coalition called Durham Beyond Policing, which is made up of several organizations in Durham, including Spirit House, Black Youth Project 100, Southerners on New Ground, where we asked for the city to implement and fund a community-led safety and wellness task force, where we could think about other things that keep us safe besides the police. We've been conditioned and become reliant on the police force to make us safe and to interact in our communities at times when it is unnecessary for police to be there. For instance, when someone's having a mental health crisis or when there is someone who may have overdosed on drugs. But we don't have the resources to provide the help and the need that the communities can utilize that is not having them to rely on people who carry guns for our own protection and our safety. We did, after doing some of that hard work, the city did agree to implement this task force. It's in the beginning stages, but it is actually something that is happening. And some of the other demands that we have are in alignment with the Movement for Black Lives. And folks can look up the Movement for Black Lives online. This is a week of action for M4BL. And there is a list of demands that everybody can request in their own cities and states for the things that Black people need that are not just about policing, but also about immediate relief. Today's demand is about immediate relief for rent and mortgages and student loans and medical bills because of what COVID-19 is doing within our communities, which also makes us unsafe. And so there are several organizations across the country that folks can tap into to see what folks are needing in their local communities.
Let me ask you, too, about some of the models, because as you say, your task force, the task force that you're a part of, is getting to work now, trying to come up with new ways. But there are models that are out there and working that you've already identified. Maybe you can give us an example of some of what you're talking about, using different intervention teams rather than police to minimize some of the violence.
Right. So there are models in Oregon where there are people who are called on when there are some of these emergencies that I'm talking about, where they are funded. There is a funded organization or a funded group of people that get called on rather than the police if someone is in crisis. There are models of different organizations reducing, for instance, their jail populations, finding other ways to hold people accountable to make sure that they show up at court. The statistics show that people will go to court if they have a court date coming up. We don't have to use bail and keep people in jail, poor people in jail, to make sure that they show up in court. So all across the country, counties, cities, states are ending money bail, which is another thing that we've been working on, so that we're not using cash as a form of holding people accountable, keeping poor people in jails and prisons when they have not even been convicted of anything. And we've been working with the state of, within the state of North Carolina around ending money bail. I know people are donating to bail funds right now, which is a good thing because we need to keep people out of jail. But the best thing that we can do in this state is to end money bail altogether. The statistics are there. They show that people go to court when they need to go to court. We don't have to keep them in jail because they're impoverished.
Adrienne Lensmith, as we look at the history of protest and the long, long history of this movement and these demands for fair policing, can you cite an example or examples of when things have really resulted in change and how you feel things are going at this moment?
Sure. I actually feel very heartened by Nia Wilson's discussion. In some ways, bringing it down to on the ground, what folks are doing makes me feel slightly better about the world, because the more I go to the federal world level, the more that I abstract out, actually, the more nihilistic I get. I think that in Los Angeles, in the wake of the 90s riots, right, the Latasha Harlan and Rodney King riots, and in San Diego, in a similar time period, there were meaningful changes around community policing that made the police more, and citizen review boards, right, more accountable to build immediate face-to-face relationships with the folks in their communities. Similarly, I think in the wake of Ferguson, the Obama Justice Department began putting in place meaningful checks on ways to oversee and make accountable police departments. But both of those examples are also reminders that progress is not eternal or linear or guaranteed, right? There were meaningful steps taken forward, and there were aggressive attempts to roll back even those partial successes. So in some ways, we can look back at historical examples of both police violence and appropriate responses to it, but we also have to keep in mind that complacency and the shortness of historical memory can do a lot of damage, even as those folks who are committed to segregationist practices in colorblind languages never let up on their onslaught of the civil rights of communities of color.
Well, it was good to talk with both of you. We will have links to Nia's organization and the various other community organizations around the country where we've seen examples of alternatives. And we thank you both for being on our program. Adrienne Lentz-Smith is an associate professor of history and African and African-American studies at Duke. Nia Wilson, executive director of Spirit House in Durham. Thank you both.
Thank you, Frank. And thank you, Nia.